And it's why I titled this video, The Number One Thing You Do Not Know About the Fed. So let's get right into it. Last night on the live stream, I was talking about an idea I've been contemplating for last few days. I think I might do a whiteboard video on it tomorrow. It's this idea that we all have. The Fed keeps interest rates artificially low. So that's the mistake the Fed makes. They keep rates too low. But I started asking myself the question, maybe they keep rates too high. Maybe sometimes they're too low. Maybe sometimes they're too high. We just assume by default that they keep rates too high at all times. But I don't think this is true. So what I did is I went back and I looked at this chart. Great chart, by the way. It's on longtermtrends.net. It takes interest rates back to 1872. Yeah, about 1872. Or excuse me, 1870. So not only does it show us the interest rates, but it shows us the inflation rate and the real rate of interest. So are real rates negative? Are they positive? And what you'll see, once the Federal Reserve is implemented, this chart looks dramatically different. Regardless of whether it's the teens, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, the 2010s, it doesn't matter. It looks completely different. So then we have to ask ourselves why. Why does this look different? First thing I want to point out that would kind of back up my point that the Fed is always wrong. Maybe not always. As my dad used to say, even a blind squirrel finds an acorn every once in a while. But they can err on both sides, and they do. They keep rates too low, but they keep rates too high. And I think right now in 2022, they could have rates too high at the front end. There's nuance here. I think because rates are too high at the front end, or possibly too high at the front end, rates are too low at the long end. So if you think about it for a moment, look at the 4-week treasury, the 1 month, it's trading under reverse repo. So this is a market rate that is a market rate, has nothing to do with the Fed. That's trading below the Fed's lowest interest rate that it manipulates. So if the Fed had rates too low, how is there a market rate that's actually lower than that? It doesn't make sense to me. Now, I get it. There's a spread there and there's some market dynamics. But to Snyder's point, the one-month treasury trading, whatever it is, 15, 20 basis points at times below reverse repo, that doesn't make any sense if interest rates were way, 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 way too low. Any market rate, you would assume, would trade at the top end of the Fed's range. So let's say 2.5%, right? And then you'd also see the interest rates or the facilities that are lending at those interest rates, or maybe borrowing at those interest rates. Maybe that's a better way to say it. You'd see the transactions increase significantly. So if you could borrow from the Fed at, let's make sure I've got this right here. If you can borrow at the Fed, let's say from the discount window, at 2.5%, we'll say that's the top end of the range. And if interest rates were way, 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 way too low, then market participants would not lend at that interest rate. They would lend at an interest rate much higher than 2.5%. Therefore, theoretically, you would expect the transactions done at that discount rate to explode higher, or whatever rate you can borrow from the Fed, let's say at the standing repo facility. So you could borrow from the Fed, and let's say that's a couple basis points lower than the discount rate, or 10 basis points, whatever. You're going to see everyone borrow at that rate, because that rate would be far lower than a market rate if rates definitively were, quote unquote, too low. So there's a lot of things here that don't really add up. I'm not saying right now interest rates are too high. I'm saying there's, again, there's a lot of things that don't add up. If we could just definitively say that rates are just way, 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 way too low, and if there was no Federal Reserve, the market rate would be higher than the CPI. I don't think you can make that statement. And here's why. Let's go back to, so what that would imply is that the overnight rate, or the closest thing to it, would never ever have a negative real yield, or there would never be negative real rates. Now, before we go any further, let me state this chart. The nominal rate of interest they're using is based on the 1-year T-bill. So not a 10-year, 30-year mortgage, not the Fed funds, the 1-year T-bill. So the shorter end of the curve. So when we go back to 1870, I think the first, oh good, and this highlighted the black line. Perfect, perfect. So this is 19, let's focus on 1870 to, really let's focus just before the Fed. So 1870 to call it 1910. And you can see the years down at the bottom of our chart. You see interest rates go up and down, but we peak out right here at around 8.35%. And to reiterate, this would be the interest rate on the approximate interest rate on the 1-year treasury. Then we see it bottom out. So a high of about 8.5, call it a low of about 3%. So there's quite a bit of fluctuation there. But keep in mind, we're dealing with a 40-year time horizon. So we have seen in the last 40 years in the United States, the Fed funds, which we'll just assume, we'll use that as though it's the same as the 1 year. Fed funds has gone from, call it 18, 19% down to 0%. So if we can assume that this is a market rate that we saw in the late 1800s, this 40-year span, and we had a delta, a maximum delta of about 5%, going from we'll call it 5.5, from 8.5 down to 3. Maximum discrepancy between the low end and the high end of 5.5%. But over the last 40 years, that delta has been 18%. That in and of itself, I think, doesn't prove anything, but I think it's a good argument to say that the Fed's getting it wrong on both ends. Right? Too high and too low. The next thing I want you to notice is how volatile, I shouldn't say volatile. Maybe that is the right word. Let's use compressed volatility. Look at in this red line, by the way, is the rate of inflation. So we go from a negative 15%, call it I don't have the exact dates here. Let's just call this 1880, roughly. And 1-2 years or so later, the inflation is at 20%. It goes from negative, or it goes from 15% deflation to 20% inflation. What did rates do? Rates went from 4.9% to 5.1%. Just let that sink in for a moment. We go from 15% deflation. And let's just say this is, it's a span of maybe 2 or 3 years. So I'm not talking about 100 years here. We're talking about 1 year, prices go down by 15%. And in the next year and a half, or 2 years or whatever, prices go up by 20%. So you're almost at a break. You basically are at a break even. And interest rates effectively didn't move. Go from 4.9 to 5.1. Now let's think about this. If today the CPI went to negative 15%, what would the Fed do? I can assure you interest rates would be zero. they would not be 4.9. Right? But let's say that inflation went to 20%. 20. I can guarantee you, or I can't guarantee, but the probability is very high. Fed funds would be above 5%. Or let's just, or the 1 year treasury would be trading over 5%, because Fed funds would go up to, I mean, who knows what it would go up to, but let's just say Fed funds went up to 5-6%. So in the 1 year, say trading at, well, right now, the 1 year is still higher than Fed funds. So maybe 40 basis. Okay. So say the 1 year is trading at 7%, something like that, but it would be trading higher even in today's day and age than 5%. And if the Fed, go back to the 1970s, thought they needed to smash inflation by taking real rates positive, then what would the one year would be at like 20%, 22% something, while with no Fed, the rate was 5.1. It's interesting, isn't it? Because again, we always, and I'm myself included, I make the mistake at always assuming the Fed has rates too low. Maybe they do, but maybe sometimes they don't. And now let's focus on this blue line, because the blue line is real interest rates. And you can see, even with the market driving the price or the yield on the 1 year, we still had times when real rates were negative, massively negative. As an example, negative 15.59% here in, call it 1880. Let's move on. 1900, real rates of interest, negative 12.26%. But when I was talking about this compressed volatility, what I mean is it was wild swings up and down, but it was like, it wasn't like you would have these wild swings that were in 20-year cycles. You would have these wild swings that were just year to year. And so if you took the average of two or three, four of these wild swinging years, you're still basically at zero. And I would assume most likely this is why the market rates, relatively speaking, didn't really move that much. They didn't, regardless of whether you had 20% inflation or 15% deflation, the interest rates were like, eh, all right, whatever. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts, Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. You definitely do not need positive real rates to bring down the rate of inflation. That we can safely conclude. So, I mean, that takes us to the 1970s. And you say, would inflation have come back down without Paul Volcker taking the rates to 18%? I think Snyder would argue yes. I don't know. Look at this chart. And so many people in this space like to argue the only way to reduce inflation is to have positive real rates. Not true. Absolutely, obviously. Look at this chart. So you could say, oh, George, well, back then they're on a gold standard, so it's different. How is it different? Could banks, were they not using fractional reserve banking here? Of course they were. So they were increasing the number of dollars Now, it is true they had a bit more of a constraint than they have today, but I think even back then there would have been ways to create loans if there was sufficient demand. So my point is maybe there was a little bit more of a constraint, but not that much. And now we don't really have fractional reserve banking. They just create as many dollars as they want. But I mean, basically, we're just talking about semantics here. It's just fractional reserve banking. The bottom line is they're creating currency units out of thin air, even if gold is the base money. And even if gold is, or even if those dollars that they're creating are redeemable for a certain number of gold ounces, or if they're redeemable for gold, I should say, still, it doesn't really put a limit. The only thing that puts a limit on there is, especially when you had free banking, the only thing that would really limit it is the public's willingness to put their gold in a bank that had a reserve ratio that was lower than XYZ bank. So I don't think you can just sit here and say, well, it's because we had the gold standard. There's far more to it than that. Now let's move on. And you can see once we get the Fed, it starts to change, doesn't it? Instead of having this compressed volatility, we'll call it, that pretty much within every 3-year period washes out or nets out to zero as far as the inflation rate. And I mean, pretty much the same thing with real rates. And real rates, I would point out, are 95% of the time, we'll call it, positive. So now we move on to the Fed, and you can see things start to change dramatically, starting with the 1910s, where instead of this compressed volatility, we just have it going in one direction, and that's up as far as inflation, and it just stays up. It doesn't come back down to where we have this deflation that nets everything out. And then let me just drag this forward here. Look at how much different this looks. No more compressed volatility. We have volatility from like decade to decade, but not year to year. And once we start pretty much in the 1933, from there on, it's just pretty much inflation. You got a couple periods of deflation, but not much. It's pretty much inflation straight up, compounded. So I guess the next question becomes, is this because of the Fed? I don't know, because I don't think there was any difference between the banking system's ability to create currency units from 1930 to call it 1950. I think the Fed was in there creating currency units during the 40s. I think you could argue, but money supply basically going up, was it going up faster than the rate of goods and services? Probably. I mean, you had supply shocks in there because of the war. But as far as the commercial banking system, I don't know if they were any more, if they were liberated, let's say, to create more and more and more currency units causing this consistent inflation. So I think you can't just blame it all on the Fed here. I think what you can do is blame it on the government, because they introduced the minimum wage and they introduced Social Security. They introduced all of these things which made it very difficult for prices to go down. Why? Because if you go back to this chart, the compressed volatility, we'll say, it's not hard to have wages go down. So if you've got prices going down by 15%, you could say, okay, well, sorry guys, I'm gonna have to adjust your wages here. Instead of $3 a day or whatever, I'm gonna pay you $2.80 per day. So so what would happen is, although you had massive rates of deflation, the business could pretty, to a certain degree, maintain their margins. But if we fast forward to minimum wage law, based on, you know, where the inflation rate is going and whatnot, you can get to a point where that minimum wage is high relatively speaking, right? Relative to historic times. And if you get that minimum wage, like let me use an example to make things a lot easier. Let's just say right now the minimum wage was $50 an hour. So what would happen if we go through a time frame of deflation? Well, businesses could only lower wages to $50. They couldn't lower it any further. So if they couldn't survive, then they'd go bust, which does what? Reduces supply. Whereas back in the 1800s or prior to the minimum wage, they could have lowered their wages from 50 to 45 to 40 based on the price of goods and services and what they were able to sell things for. You see? So if you've got that elasticity with wages, you're going to have fewer businesses go bust because of an economic downturn, or you're going to have fewer businesses go bust when prices go down. Because again, their margins aren't being squeezed as much. If you have fewer businesses going out of business, you don't have as dramatic a reduction to the supply of goods and services, which means if you don't have that reduction, then you don't have as much consumer price inflation. It's like that minimum wage, along with Social Security, along with welfare, food stamps, if you will. It's like that put in a floor to the rate of inflation, to where it's very difficult for the rate of inflation to go down past a certain level for a sustained period of time, because the businesses will just go bust. And if the businesses go bust, then there's just less goods and services, right? And you say, well, George, if the businesses are going bust, then yes, it would reduce supply, but it would also reduce demand. But let's remember, when we brought out the minimum wage in the 1930s, they also brought out Social Security. They brought out welfare. So what this does is this creates an environment where you can eliminate the supply side or reduce the supply side very quickly, but it's or even more quickly, but it's far more difficult to reduce the demand side, or the demand side won't go down as quickly as it did in the 1800s. So this, I think, is along with the Fed, I'm not saying, but everyone likes to say because of the Federal Reserve, as if we didn't have the Federal Reserve, we would no longer have inflation. It would look more like the 1800s. I don't know. I think that's a huge contributing factor, but I think it has a lot to do with government regulation. And I think it would be a fascinating thought experiment to try to envision the 1900s with Social Security, with minimum wage, with welfare, or whatever the hell it's called now, and but without the manipulation of short-term interest rates. Would we have seen this same type of red line from the mid-1930s to today, where it's pretty much just always inflation? It's just a matter of how much or how little inflation are we getting. And I think there's other government regulations that play into that. But going back to the original topic of the video, I don't think looking at these two charts, one without a central bank, one with a central bank, I don't know that you can sit here and safely conclude with 100% confidence the Fed always errs on the side of keeping interest rates too low. I think they err on both sides. That's really my point. And I think what they have done is they've increased volatility, oddly enough, with interest rates. But they've, with interest rates, I was going to say they've increased the volatility, but they've compressed the time frame. But with the interest rates, they really haven't done that. But they have decreased, I guess, the volatility. But they have, they've decreased they haven't decreased the volatility either. What am I looking for? They have just increased the time frame from one volatile decade to the next volatile decade, while increasing the absolute level of volatility. So let me So you can see now, instead of having, and again, this could be a result of government regulation as well, but instead of having 1 year of 15% down, 1 year of 20% up, and bam, 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 now we just go, we have decades that it's all up. And then we have decades where it's all down. And then we have decades where it's pretty much sideways. So I think what they've tried to do, and maybe they've been successful at doing this, is for time frames, yes, they decrease volatility at the cost of wildly more volatility during certain decades. And I guess then the question becomes, what's better? Is it better to have these market forces in these wild swings, or is it better to have a couple decades of pretty much flat inflation, but then at the expense of going through one decade of massive deflation the entire decade, or massive inflation the entire decade? I think the answer lies in the rate of interest, because I think a Keynesian or someone that was a central planner would say, oh, well, it's far with price stability, it's far easier to make business decisions. But is it? It depends on the type of price stability you're talking about. Because I think they would argue their definition of price stability is where things are the same for a decade at a time. Where the definition of price stability, if you go back to the 1800s, would be that the rate of inflation was the same from three-year period to three-year period, and that was zero. That we had price stability, meaning the prices were the same. They're never the same from year to year, but from three-year to three-year, they're always the same. So that's a different type of price stability. And if you're asking, okay, which one does the market prefer? I think you have to look at the interest rates themselves on the 1 year and look at how the volatility or the delta, like we were saying earlier, on the 1 year is far less during the 1800s than it was during the last 40 years. I mean, look at how the wild swings in interest rates from 81 to 86. We went from, let's just call it 17, 18% down to basically 6%, 5.78 on the 1 year. You never saw those types of swings, even for a 40-year period in the late 1800s. So I think this would be the market saying that what the Fed or the government has created, their type of price stability, is far less stable in the eyes of the market than the volatility that we had from year to year back in the 1800s. And just to be clear, I'm saying this because the delta or the discrepancy between the top and the bottom of the interest rates was far lower in the 1880s, although the fluctuation from year to year was far higher. So, like I said, that's probably one thing, or maybe even the number one thing, that you did not know about the Fed. Because no one looks at a chart going back to the 1870s. But if you do, you really find out, you learn a lot about today by studying history. And when most financial planners study history, they go back to 1980. No. That's not studying financial history. You need to go back to 1880, not 1980. And then if you do, you can get a lot more information that hopefully will help you connect some dots today, see things more clearly, and help better predict probabilities of what may happen in the future with markets, interest rates, and the rate of inflation due to the Fed getting it wrong both ways. Not only do they keep interest rates artificially low, they also keep them artificially high. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. As always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism. We'll see you in the next video.